This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
All these things have usually a financial incentive. It's more often, at least in my view, motivated by economic incentives than it is by pure evil.
Welcome back to Sea Change Radio. This is Alex Wise. We're going to try something a little different this week. Usually I like to ask the questions, but with the election a week away, I wanted to share some of my thoughts about the upcoming election with all of you before we dive into this week's guest from the Sea Change Radio archives, Ian Urbina of the New York Times, who wrote a book called The Outlaw Ocean. So we're all very nervous about the upcoming election. Who in their right mind wouldn't be? There's so much at stake. But I'm cautiously optimistic, and I believe in polls. It's the best data we have. And looking at the polls and the turnout numbers, I think it's very encouraging for Joe Biden, and I also wanted to look at some of the Senate races later on. But first, let's look at the presidential election. Looking at the polls combined with the fact that 67 million people have already voted. It's looking like this will be the biggest turnout since 1908, according to Michael McDonald, an elections professor at University of Florida. He projects a 65% turnout. And if you compare that to the 2016 presidential election, I think the turnout totals were closer to 57%. And as we know, when more people vote, Democrats win. That's one of the reasons why we've seen so much voter suppression over the last decade plus from the right wing. They realize when everybody votes, they don't win. It's also worth noting that there are fewer undecided voters in this election, and that favors Joe Biden as well and makes the polling data less fuzzy. Now, I know everyone likes to say that the polling was wrong in 2016, and so we can't ever trust polls again. But polling was actually pretty accurate. For example, in 2016, the race tightened and had Hillary Clinton up by around 3% right before the election. She ended up winning the popular vote by 2.1%. So that's within the margin of error. And we know the rest of the story when it comes to swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and how those turned out. Yes, the battleground states ended up being closer than the polls had projected. But that doesn't mean polling is always wrong. Churchill is often credited, rightly or wrongly, with saying something to the effect that democracy is the worst form of government except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. So polling is similar. If somebody has a better way of projecting election returns, I'm not aware of it. So let's continue looking at the forecast based on polling. The latest forecast from The Economist has Joe Biden with a 93% chance of winning the Electoral College. 538, Nate Silver's site, gives Biden an 87% chance. And as each day gets closer to the election and the polls don't shift, we can assume that Biden's chances will get even greater. And The Economist has the Electoral College votes going 345 to Biden, Trump with 193. I personally think it's going to be even greater. I think Biden is going to take a state like Texas or Georgia and exceed that 345 number by a little bit. Florida will be close. Ohio will probably go red. That state is going the way of Indiana. It's really not much of a swing state anymore, but Ohio is being replaced by other blue hopeful states like Arizona, North Carolina, and Texas and Georgia. And to be clear, Joe Biden and Democrats aren't counting on winning Texas and Georgia. But I won't be shocked if it happens. Now let's look at the turnout numbers, because those have been off the charts. There's just a lot of enthusiasm with this election, whether it be support for Joe Biden or hatred of Donald Trump or the fact that people have a little more free time on their hands because of the vast unemployment numbers stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. I don't know. But let's look at some of the numbers. 79% of requested absentee ballots in Wisconsin have been returned a week before the election. So that's a swing state where people are engaged. Same thing goes with Texas. Turnout there has been really high. Texas has been very engaged politically, despite efforts by Governor Abbott there to try to quell early voting. Suddenly, Texas has become the nation's top early voting state. We've seen a tidal wave of political engagement there. More than 7 million Texans have already cast a ballot during the general election. That means 43% of registered voters statewide had voted as of this past Sunday. That's 80% of the total turnout from 4 years ago, by comparison. So that's very impressive. And when we look at the way polling has skewed red in Texas, in 2018, for example, Ted Cruz was leading by, according to aggregate of polls, 6.8% for the midterms in his race against Beto O'Rourke, but ended up beating Beto by 2.3%. And while there was a recent New York Times poll out that said that Trump is doing better than expected with Hispanic voters and projects the president keeping that state by a narrow margin, Joe Biden has led a few polls there, and turnout in large counties like Harris County and Houston and Tarrant and Fort Worth, turnout numbers have been off the charts there. So I think Texas is a true toss-up at this point, which is pretty stunning. And when we consider that the Republicans have all been putting their eggs in the Election Day basket, that is, voting on Election Day as opposed to early voting and mail-in ballots, they are counting on a big surge on Election Day. But this race has been holding pretty steady for 6 months, and we have a week to go. I don't think we're going to see a real sudden shift in the polls. And you just have to wonder how many Republican voters are going to want to stand in line for hours in the middle of a global pandemic if their candidate has already lost in the eyes of the media come Election Day. Now, I've heard a lot of the doomsday scenarios. There's a lot of reasons for angst, and people are nervous, and you can find a dozen different reasons to think why things might go south. But if you see the writing on the wall from how the Republican Party is acting, from pushing through the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation process in rapid fire before the election, to senators like Ben Sasse making comments distancing himself from President Trump, I think it's pretty clear that the Republican Party does not expect to win the general election on November 3rd. Now, battleground states will be closer, in the 3-5% range rather than the 7.97-9% range we've been seeing nationally, and that makes people nervous. But traditional red states like Georgia and Texas will be closer. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and we're talking the 2020 election. Let's now turn to the Senate, which is very much in the balance. 538, Nate Silver's site, which I mentioned earlier, is projecting the Democrats have a 74% chance to take control of the Senate. Let's break down the seats in some of the closer races. So Democrat Doug Jones is looking like he's going to probably lose to Tommy Tuberville, the old Auburn football coach who has no political experience in Alabama. So that is probably going to turn from a blue seat to a red seat. That means Democrats have 4 or 5 other seats to gain, depending upon who wins the general election. Mark Kelly is comfortably ahead in Arizona over Martha McSally, the Republican. So that cancels out that right there. So Doug Jones will give up his seat, but Mark Kelly is almost definitely going to beat Martha McSally. And Colorado is also not extremely close at this juncture. It's looking like John Hickenlooper is going to beat Cory Gardner there. So the Democrats, according to my little back of the envelope calculations, are up one seat. Let's turn to North Carolina, which is a critical swing state, and it's been favoring Joe Biden consistently for the past couple of months over Donald Trump. The Democrat Cal Cunningham has seen his lead shrunk with his little sexting scandal over Tom Tillis, the incumbent Republican. But all the reputable polls in North Carolina have Cunningham with a lead of some sort, and if Biden does perform as expected or even overperform, Cunningham should be able to beat Tillis. So let's say that's two seats right there. Sarah Gideon is leading the Republican Susan Collins in Maine, and if we project that to go blue, that's three seats. Now it gets a little thornier moving into some of these other races. Teresa Greenfield and Joni Ernst are in a really tight race, Greenfield being the Democrat and Ernst is the incumbent Republican. Iowa's a battleground state, though, so a big Biden victory might flip that, although Ernst is ahead by a hair in most of the polls. In Georgia, it's a little more confusing because they have a special election, and for Raphael Warnock, the Democrat, to take that seat, he'd have to get over 50% of the votes to avoid a runoff versus the incumbent Kelly Loeffler. Right now, he's in the high 40s, so that race may not be decided until January. The Democrat John Ossoff will have to eke out an upset, though, to beat Republican David Perdue in Georgia, as Perdue continues to hold narrow polling margins. Now, there's two interesting races in the Senate in South Carolina and Texas. In South Carolina, Jamie Harrison is narrowly behind Lindsey Graham, and MJ Hagar is narrowly behind John Cornyn in Texas. I'm guessing in the end, Republicans hold both of those seats, but you never know, and these are very close races. Kansas and Alaska, a little less rosy for Democrats. In Kansas, Republican Roger Marshall will probably beat Barbara Bollier by a narrow margin, and incumbent Republican Dan Sullivan looks like he's going to hold off Al Gross in Alaska. But the fact that these races are in single digits in deep red states do not bode well for the Republican chances on the whole on November 3rd. And I should also mention Montana with the Battle of the Steves. We have Republican Steve Daines versus Democrat Steve Bullock, and Daines is narrowly favored, but that's going to be a toss-up as well. So I think the Democrats have, let's say, two to three seats comfortably in their corner with another five toss-up states. So if one or two of those go in favor of the Democrats, then you have a democratically controlled Senate moving forward. Okay, so those are my thoughts on the election. Cautiously optimistic from the Democratic standpoint. I probably will be wrong. I would have mortgaged my house that Hillary Clinton would have won in 2016, and I was completely wrong. So take it all with a grain of salt, but get out there and vote. Make your voices heard. Make phone calls for candidates you feel strongly about. And now back to covering the shift to sustainability with Ian Urbina of the New York Times. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ian Urbina. He is an author and an investigative reporter. He writes for the New York Times, among other outlets. Ian, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So the Outlaw Ocean is quite an undertaking. You've covered pretty much all of the globe in your pursuit of understanding what goes on our oceans, in our oceans, in terms of crime, commerce. It's pretty massive in its scale. Why don't you take a step back and talk about what you were hoping to accomplish when you began this journey?
So I hoped to do a couple things. One was to approach this space that is offshore as a frontier, and a frontier where a lot of people work. You know, 56 to 60 million people work offshore, and you rarely hear about them, and they're pretty essential to the global economy. 90% of everything travels by way of ship, and you know, 30-40%, depending on where you are in the world, of the protein consumed comes out of that water. And so it just struck me that it would be a public service sort of anthropologically to chronicle who's out there and what's happening. And more specifically, the ambition was to broaden the spectrum of understanding about the abuses that occur out there, be they human rights or labor or environmental abuses. Most folks thought of, you know, when you say maritime crime, they think of Captain Phillips, you know, Somali piracy or the BP spill. And having worked out there before, I knew there was a lot more going on, and I kind of wanted to convey that to the public.
Why don't you first give an overview of all the different areas that you covered and how long your research took before you could actually call this a finished product?
I'm not even sure I can call it now a finished product, but I get your point. I mean, I think so it's been about 5 years since the sort of first sit down I had with my editor and the launching and the reporting. I'm, you know, kind of spend the next probably 3 to 5 continuing on it. The diversity of kind of crimes and abuses that we covered range from sea slavery, so human slavery on fishing vessels, to arms trafficking and sometimes on camera murder, you know, by private maritime security guards, to intentional dumping of oil at sea by ships, to illegal whaling, to oil and gas drilling of questionable legality, to murder and abuse of stowaways, to overfishing and illegal fishing. So there's a real range of the kinds of phenomena, if you will, that we sought to explain.
Let me read to our listeners a blurb that John Kerry wrote about the book. John Kerry, former Secretary of State and Senator from Massachusetts, he wrote, "This book is a gripping chronicle of the watery Wild West, and it shows us, frankly, unlike anything I've read before, how global indifference can trap innocent people in endless cycles of exploitation, how the vast ocean has become a danger zone, and ultimately, how we all pay a price for this mayhem and mistreatment." So, diving a little deeper into the mayhem and mistreatment, where were some of the more unlikely stories that you found yourself? I imagine when you first were brainstorming this idea with your editors, you were thinking, well, I'd be going to Indonesia, maybe Japan. There were some more obvious low-hanging fruit stories for you, which you unearthed very effectively. But maybe you can kind of take us on some of the more unlikely twists and turns.
Yeah, and the unlikely, sort of surprising, oddball ones were not necessarily about acute human rights abuses. So two examples come to mind. One was off the coast of England, this place called Sealand, which is by some accounts the smallest independent country in the world. It's really a former gunnery platform from World War II that at the time was planted in international waters near the coast of England. And a kind of daring, wild-eyed family, the Bates family, decided they were going to, when the war was over and there was no use for it anymore, take over this platform and declare it a principality. And they did just that. And it has indeed been, by some measures, a sovereign nation ever since. And it's just this odd sort of libertarian goofball place that has a fascinating history of attempted takeovers by other wild men and by the government of England, and negotiations with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and all sorts of mafia types who through the years were somehow associated with this strange place. So I went out there and spent some time in the Principality of Sealand just to chronicle that. And that was great fun and fascinating. And I think made a good point. A similar sort of example to your question of surprising characters or places was off the coast of Mexico and an embed that my photographer, Fabio Nascimento, a Brazilian photographer, and I went down to report on the work of a Dutch woman named Rebecca Gompertz, who runs an organization called Women on Waves, which essentially is a ship that goes to places in the world where abortion is illegal and sometimes quite dangerous for those attempting to get one. And Gompertz is a doctor and has a crew of other OBGYN doctors, and they bring the ship near. They surreptitiously bring young women on board and take them out past the 13-mile mark into international waters, and don't perform surgical abortions, but do perform medical abortions, which means RU486, you know, administers the pills that induce miscarriage. And here again, I was interested in what she does as yet another example of the sort of way that this space out there is otherworldly and operates by different rules.
In a modern society where we can get all-you-can-eat shrimp for $7.99 at some restaurant down the street, how can so much pain be connected to something that's supposed to be an enjoyable experience, eating something delicious from the sea? How has that shaped your perspective on eating seafood after these years of research? And maybe you can kind of connect the dots for our listeners in terms of some of the worst human rights abuses and the food that we eat.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the way I came to think about the connection between the cheap stuff we get and the cheap stuff we consume on the one hand, and the pretty dark things that precede that arrival to our mouths or our plates or our doorstep via Amazon, whatever, is best understood through sort of the notion of hidden costs, right? So I think the globalized economy has decentralized how things get made and things arrive to our doorstep, and more so than any time in history. And that sort of, not to be too Marxian here, kind of alienation from the labor that goes into the stuff that we consume allows for two things: one, abuse, and two, savings. The savings are, you know, we have impossibly cheap things put at our fingertips, and they are impossible. Like, and the abuses are typically cost saving abuses that allow for those savings. So, you know, in a tight margin industry like fishing, where there's not a whole lot of profit to be made in the best of worlds, when the price of the fish bottoms out, the people trying to pull it out of the water are going to look for ways to make ends meet, and they're going to be much more inclined to dump oil than bring it legally back to shore, or to use migrant debt bonded laborers from, you know, another country that and pay them you know, slave wages or not at all, etc. So to use nets that they shouldn't use, to travel closer to a space where they're not allowed to fish because it saves them on fuel. You know, all these things have usually a financial incentive. It's more often, at least in my view, motivated by economic incentives than it is by pure evil.
I was surprised to learn that these fishing vessels, some of the larger ones, are actually have processing plants of a sort on board, and they're some of the most dangerous factory conditions on the planet. Maybe you can expand on that, if you will.
I was equally surprised. I mean, they're not even sort of, you know, that there are full-on factories that are huge and bustling and, you know, kind of Willy Wonka style conveyor belts everywhere. And meanwhile, there's water often coming in and guys are standing in, you know, 1 to 2 foot deep water sometimes in some areas because, you know, just water comes on ships. And sometimes they're also using the water, the seawater to flow in and flow out and clean the fish guts in a sort of low cost way. And some of these factories have 20, 30 guys on them. Fabio and I went to Antarctica on a Chilean toothfish vessel a couple months ago to tell a story. And it was a factory ship. And it had, you know, when it was bustling, a good 30 guys down below just moving these huge fish down the production line. And they come on board through one portal. And they go all the way down this line. And by the end, they're sliced into pieces that have different and boxed and taped and put in this whole organized system in, you know, heavy duty freezers, all the way, you know, through the production line, ready to be, you know, put on trucks when they get back to shore.
And how did you get on some of these ships? I assume that they knew you were an investigative journalist. What kind of reception did you get, and did you have like an agent arranging these passages for you, or you just dealt with it directly?
So I dealt directly. We're not ever allowed to mislead or misconvey who we are. So I would always have to say who I was and what I, you know, my profession was. I didn't go into depth always as to what I was writing about because often I didn't know. Usually it was just, I want to chronicle what life and work is like here, you know, in this space. And these relationships and getting on board these ships take a lot of time and interaction and trust ultimately that you kind of have to build up. And so, you know, it's a lot of when it's really hard to do over the phone or by email. Usually you can initiate that, but then you usually need to fly to wherever and go out to dinner a couple times with the said captain and have them just grill you a bit and get a sense for sort of suss you out and get a sense for, do you seem like someone who would pull a fast one on them? And also, do you really understand what this space is like? And usually when I got to that stage where I'm sitting across the table from one of these guys, I was in good shape because I've spent a lot of time on these vessels and usually had done a lot of homework on that particular individual and that kind of fishing and being just sort of proactively transparent and having done your homework and being respectful and being fluent in their world gets you a long way.
Well, it's a terrific book. It's called The Outlaw Ocean. Ian Urbina, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jazz is Dead, Cubanismo, and Elliot Smith.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.